Okay, this is 4:55 on November 30th, Monday.
So it turns out that they figured out the mathematics behind, some mathematics behind that. They didn't completely succeed at that stage, but the idea did seem to have some value, and mathematical types continued to pursue it over the next 5 years or so, coming up with some algorithms today that people think are indeed quite secure, and use this public key technique. So, there are a lot of uses for public key cryptography, and they don't all follow this pattern. But for in the encryption use of public key cryptography, the encryption key is something that is known to everybody. It's published. You can print it in the newspaper. And then each individual, that is, each individual's encryption key is known publicly, and each individual has then a private key that they keep to themselves. Okay? And you can see how this works then. If I want to send a message to Nick, I encrypt something with his public key. Nobody else can read it because the public key doesn't do any good for decrypting. It's only good for encrypting. And Nick, when he gets it, can decrypt it using his private key. All right. So that's the basic idea, and I guess that's shown here. We're using K plus to mean the public key and K minus to mean the private key. So we encrypt using the public key, decrypt using the private key, and recover the original message. All right? That's the whole idea, and it's a great idea, you know, and if there weren't the supporting mathematics, it would be no good at all, right? Because if systems of keys that and functions that do this process don't exist, then this would just be a sort of pie in the sky idea. But it turned out that they did. Okay. So what are the requirements then on the mathematical system and the keys that have to hold for this thing to work? Basically, the idea is that if you know the public key, it should be essentially impossible to compute the private key, because everybody knows the public key, right? And if somebody could compute the private key, the system wouldn't work. That's what it has to do. There have been several attempts, starting in 1976, there were several attempts to build systems of functions and keys that would do this, and people thought they had them working, and then somebody would come along, and there was one of the famous ones that happened was that somebody had invented, actually the originators of this had invented a system based on the so-called knapsack problem, which you may have encountered in 450. It's a great encryption system. And then somebody else at a major conference got up and showed that with an Apple II computer, which was sort of has less computing power than this device on my neck, with an Apple II computer, we're able to break the keys. Okay, so it was thought to be a great thing, and then we're sort of reset. But the so-called RSA algorithm, their initials of people's names, Rivest, Shamir, and Adelson, I think they're all at MIT, invented this system that we're going to look at now called the RSA encryption scheme, and so far it has stood up to the test of time over nearly 30 years now. So to understand how this thing works, we have to go back and refresh our discrete math knowledge of modular arithmetic. And the key operation is mod, which is the remainder of x1 divided by n. All right, so just remember that. It's a good thing to to have in your and the properties are a good thing to have in your mental toolkit anyway for a lot of reasons. So remember that the modulus operation is invariant under addition, subtraction, multiplication, exponentiation. Right, so all of these things sort of work the way you would expect them to. A mod n to the d mod n is a to the d mod n, stuff like that. All right, so just simple, basic modular arithmetic rules. Everybody should be pretty familiar with that. Yes? No? Okay. I mean, remember, when we do 32-bit arithmetic on computers, we're doing it modulo 2 to the 32, right? All the time, anyway. Okay, so here's the mental picture you have to get of this. We send messages. We think of them as characters. But we've already talked about how the characters get turned into bits, right, in order to send them over wires or store them in computers. And so a message is, in fact, a bit pattern, and any bit pattern is interpretable as a number. Right? You just have a lot of bits, treat it as a number. And so this whole problem of encryption is not really about manipulating symbols at all, it's about computing with numbers, at least in the public key version of this. We don't talk about, you know, tearing apart the message and flipping around the order of the bits or anything like that, or doing table lookups. We're not doing any of that now. We're just treating it as a number, treating the message as a number. And to encrypt M, we do some function on a number and get a different number. Okay, so here's the RSA scheme. We start out by choosing large prime numbers. And I'll just say now, large, 1,024 bits. That's a pretty big, good size. There are a lot of them to be had, of course. It turns out that while it's hard to... sort of enumerate all the primes up to that large size, it's pretty easy to pick a random prime of that size. You can pick a random number and easily test whether it's prime, and keep doing that until you come across one that is. So that's pretty easy. Multiplying 2,024-bit numbers, that's not too hard. And computing this number z, which is p minus 1 times q minus 1, is also not hard. Then, so that's part one of this thing. Next thing we do is we choose another number that is smaller than n, and has no common factors with z. And it turns out that's also easy to do. And I'm not going to go into the mathematics of this. There's a great book on all of this by Bruce Schneier. Called Applied Cryptography. It's been through several editions now. He goes through all the mathematics and the proofs and the like that you need to understand why this works. These days, all of this stuff is implemented in libraries that you can use without really having to understand much about the mathematics. But it's useful to just sort of, at a high level, go through this stuff. Then we have to choose another number, d, so that e times d is 1 mod z up here. Okay, so this all seems like sort of really random-ish sorts of rules that you go through. But it turns out that when you do all this, you end up with two different pairs of numbers, NE and ND, which can be used as public and private keys. And it turns out that it doesn't actually matter, I think, which of these you use as the public key and which is the private key. It's pretty symmetric in that regard. So we have N and E, N and D. So encryption then is just a mathematical function on the message. Raise it to the power E and take it mod N. Okay? Now notice that N here is what? The product of 2024-bit primes. So when we take mod N, we end up with something that's about 2048 bits long. And therefore, we have to be sure that we don't ever try to encrypt a message that is too big. Right? Because if we encrypt a message that's too big, we're going to necessarily lose information. So each of these choices of N imposes a limit on the size of the M that you can encrypt, and therefore we'll be back to doing some of those tricks that we did for symmetric key cryptography to break things up into blocks, do blockchaining and the like, if we want to encrypt very big messages. But in some of the system stuff that we'll talk about, we'll see that we can get by with not actually ever having to encrypt very big messages using these techniques. Okay, so this is encryption, and decryption is take the ciphertext, C, raise it to the power D, and take the result mod N. All right, so pretty straightforward. These are expensive operations computationally. They take quite a long time. And therefore, public key encryption has a reputation of being quite slow compared with symmetric key encryption. And so what we're going to do in a system sense is figure out ways to use public key encryption to leverage ourselves into a way of using symmetric key encryption. Okay, so here's an example using small primes. P and Q, the primes, 5 and 7, the product is 35, and Z, which is P minus 1 times Q minus 1, is 24. We need to have E relatively prime to Z, right? So 5 is 5 and 1, 6, 2... Yeah, 3, 2, and 4. So that's relatively prime. And then we pick D so that E times D minus 1 is divisible by 24. And I guess, what is that, 145 is E times D, and 144 is divisible by 24. So let's check it out. To encrypt the message 12, raise it to the fifth power and take mod 35 at 17. Do it backwards. All right. So, you know, I mean, play with a calculator if you want to do some of these. But, you know, it's simple enough to write down the mathematical formulas. Okay, so why does it work? C to the D mod N is supposed to be equal to M, right? Otherwise it's not, otherwise you don't get the original message. So, and C is already M to the E mod N, and so when we write this out, C to the D mod N is M to the E mod N to the D mod N, which is, and now using the modular arithmetic rules, M to the ED mod N. And then we need this other fact, which is x to the y mod n is x to the y mod z, and z is p minus 1 times q minus 1. So e to the d mod z we chose such that it was 1, so this is m to the 1 mod m to the 1 mod n is just n. All right, okay. Provided, as we said, m is less than n. Essential. Go ahead and write that down. Okay. And it turns out that this thing works either direction. So you can use the public key first and decrypt with the private key, but you can do it the other way around. You can encrypt with the private key and decrypt with the public key. And that just follows from the fact that, you know, we're talking about m to the ed, right? Throughout here. Well, that's the same as m to the de. And so it's easy to see that this property will hold. And this gives us a very useful feature of public key cryptography, which we'll come to in a moment. So n is public and e is public. What does it take to determine d? Well, it turns out that you have to find the factors of n in order to determine d. This is the prime factoring problem. Nobody actually knows whether prime factoring is hard or not, in the computational sense of hard. But nobody knows how to do it either. Right? So any faster than essentially random trials. Right? Try everything. Exhaustive trials is what I should say. So they lie a little bit here in saying that it is hard. It's not provably hard. It's just hard in our experience. And people have been working at it for centuries without success, but other problems that people have worked at for centuries have succumbed in recent decades, like the four-color theorem, right? And other things. So at the moment, everybody believes that this is an okay thing to use and that your secrets will remain secure using this. Okay, so now into the systems perspective on all of this. I said that the RSA encryption and decryption is expensive computationally. The symmetric key algorithms are much, much faster. So to overcome this computational expense, the typical use is that we use RSA to securely communicate what's called a session key which is a symmetric key, right? And so we use this very expensive operation to communicate a relatively small bit of information and then use that as the cryptographic scheme for communicating the large messages. And this also then points out how we get away with not really worrying too much about the size of the messages. The symmetric key, session key, can generally be much smaller than 2048 bits without any difficulty and still be secure. So that's that. Okay. So the plan then is to talk about approaches to message integrity and secure email, typical uses of cryptography, and then talk about some standardized library-level stuff that incorporates cryptography as well. So the when we think about cryptography, right, we immediately think about communicating secretly, ensuring that only the recipient of the message can see the content of the message. But it turns out that in computer systems, we're also very much interested, even if we don't care so much about secrecy, we're very interested in ensuring that the recipient actually got the message that the sender sent, as opposed to some other message. Okay? Also very important. People can inject messages and send you messages that are fake. They can get you to do things that probably you don't want to do. So, things that we care about, the content hasn't been altered, the source is what you think it was. This one is something that we often forget about, but is important. Suppose somebody sends you a message and sometime later somebody else manages to send you that same message and makes you think it's a new message. I actually had this happen to me last night. I was going through I was looking at some old emails for some purpose, and I had filtered my email in such a way that when I looked at a message that looked like it was new, it was actually a year old. What was it? It was a bill from the utility company. I almost set out to pay that bill again. Okay? Because I was confused. Nobody was trying to fool me, but it was sort of very similar to what can happen with a replay attack. Okay, so and sometimes it's important that messages be interpreted in order. Okay, so to accomplish all of these things, there's a sort of weaker cryptographic scheme called message digests that can provide these assurances without doing full-blown cryptography. So remember what a hash function is. We've talked about hash functions before. It takes an input of arbitrary length and returns a fixed length string. Okay? So we're going to be interested in hash functions that have some particular properties. We've seen hash functions for a lot of purposes. We use them in sorting and looking up, building index tables and so on. Hash functions used there are not really good enough for cryptographic use. We have some additional properties in mind. But sharing with all those other hash functions, these hash functions do have the property that they are many-to-one functions. That is, there are many different messages that all hash to the same value. And that has to be the case because the messages can be arbitrarily long and the size of the hash result is fixed. Right? So there are arbitrarily many messages that hash to the same value. For the purposes that we have in mind now, in addition to the standard properties of being easy to calculate and having seemingly random output, we're also going to be very interested in ensuring that it's hard to go from the hash value to a message that has the hash value, and also that it's hard to find two messages that have the same hash value. Okay? Because if you can ensure these properties, then you can assure some of those other more interesting properties that we have, that we desire about message authentication. Okay, so the internet checksum is a hash value. It's many to one, it's fixed length, it's easy to compute, and it does produce seemingly random values, but it fails the other two tests, right? So again, then you have to haul in the mathematicians to figure out how to build these things right. There are a couple of commonly used ones these days. MD here stands for Message Digest. There have been multiple iterations by the folks who promulgate these things. We're currently up to 5, and 5 is pretty acceptable these days. Okay, so MD5 is from RSA, I think. I think it's from the same guys. SHA, Secure Hash Algorithm, is a standard promulgated by the federal government with the idea of making something that was more sort of publicly supported than the MD5 commercial version. Uses a lot of the same techniques. I actually wrote some code to do this once upon a time. It's not too tough to implement. It's easy to make mistakes, but 160 bits. So what can you do with these things? Oh, and both of these have the additional desirable properties that it's hard to go from a hash to a message having that hash, and it's hard to find two messages that have the same hash. Okay. And by hard here, I mean in the computational sense that you talk about in Computer Science 450, right? So exponentially complex algorithms, as far as anyone knows. Okay. So, lots of ways to use these things. Here's one way. Suppose the sender and receiver have a shared secret, and we're not going to do encryption with that shared secret at this point. We're just going to do hashing to create what are called message authentication codes, MACs. We take the secret and the message and concatenate them and hash that. And we get relatively few bits, right? 128, 160 bits. Remember how many bytes that is. That's 16 to 20 bytes. And you can do this on an arbitrarily large message. We stick those 16 to 20 bytes onto the message and send it off into the ether, where eventually it shows up at the receiver as, and what comes out here is just this much, right? The receiver tacks on the secret to the message, hashes it, gets some result, and compares it to what came along with the message. If they're the same, the message is intact, right? That's message integrity. Furthermore, because the secret is something that's shared only by the sender and receiver, at least that was our assumption, we also know that the message came from the sender who has that secret. So we've authenticated the sender. So we haven't done any encryption. Anybody out here in the internet can read that message, but we do know that it came from who we expected it to come from and that it's not been tampered with. So this is called keyed hashing.
Okay.
So we're starting to mix together these techniques to do interesting things in the system sense. Okay. Hashed method message authentication code. This is standardized. I'm sorry, I don't know the number. And you can read in the book about why they actually hash things twice. Subtle security flaws. Do you know, Vic? Why the HMAC doesn't use this simple version that hashes once but instead hashes twice? Yeah. Puts the secret on the message, hashes that, puts the secret on the front of the digest and hashes that. So I don't know. Maybe so. Okay. Okay, here's a practical example of the use of this stuff. When we talked about routing, right, we have messages going around between the routers saying, here's my distance vector, or here's my interpretation of the state of the links. If you're actually a router, you'd probably like to know that those messages were coming from other routers that you know about, right, as opposed to Joe random user who happens to have an internet connection and can send you distance vectors or link state information. So OSPF, a relatively recent standard implementation of link state, actually defines as part of the standard the ability to include cryptographic hashes with its messages. Now, we don't really care about the content of those messages, right? It isn't really all that much of a secret whether a particular link is up or down, but we really do care that the information we're getting is correct, reflects the knowledge of somebody who actually has access to that link and can tell us whether it's up or down. And so OSPF includes the ability to use cryptographic hashing on the link state information. Okay. Also includes the possibility to not do authentication or to just include passwords, clear text passwords in the messages, which is sort of really bad practice. Something that when you include the clear text of a password in a message, you might as well assume that the world knows it. Yes?
So is the shared secret the same for every message? Because it seems like it's always the same, then having the hash is as good as having the password.
Having the hash is as good as... Oh, because you can replay the messages.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So that brings up the next problem. And we'll illustrate it here. Suppose we send... that Alice tells Bob to pay Trudy $1 million... and Trudy gets her hands on that message and plays it back to Bob at a later time. Well, Bob probably doesn't really want to give her another $1 million just because she said so. So to overcome that problem, we include something in the message that changes over time. Right? And so that thing is called a nonce. And it can be done in a number of ways. It can be done just by incrementing a counter, by including a timestamp, or in this case, another possibility is to do kind of a challenge response thing where Alice says to Bob, I'm Alice and I want to send you something that we need to ensure happens right now. Bob sends to Alice a value, a random value, and then Alice sends to back to Bob something that includes that random value in the hash. And so Bob knows then that he got back something that was directly in response to his random value. Okay. So lots of different ways of doing nonces. Okay. So that's that's the idea of MACs, message authentication codes, and hashing. And now we're ready to talk about the next use of public key cryptography, primarily, although we'll see a way to do it with shared key as well. So we've said how to get messages from Alice to Bob secretly. But we're also going to find that we can assure Bob that Alice was the originator of the message. Okay? And that's called digitally signing. So it's very much like when you go in and sign your loan for your car, right? They want to ensure that it's really you. They make you produce identification and so on and so forth. But the thing that goes on the document is your signature. The goal here is that the recipient can prove to, say, the court that Bob and no one else must have been the person who signed the document. And the primary threat here is the recipient of the document themselves, right? And it turns out that signatures that you do on paper are actually not very good at this, right? If you sign a document and give it to somebody, they have the ability to copy that signature, learn to copy that signature, right? Put it on some other document that you didn't sign. This is a common fraud on mortgages, right? Where a spouse, say, will sign for their spouse, and the spouse doesn't know anything about it. So digital signatures can be better than handwritten signatures. So what do we do? Public key. Encrypt now with a private key. Encrypt with the private key. Remember that symmetry we saw before. Encrypt with the private key. Decrypt with the public key. But public key cryptography is slow, so rather than encrypting the whole message, let's use a hash function to reduce the size that has to be encryption and only encrypt the hash value instead of the whole message. Okay? So we can do it without providing secrecy. What is this thing? I looked at this in the book. I looked at it here. I still don't know what this is supposed to represent. It's the message. But why it's that picture, I don't know. We put the message together with an encrypted message digest, which is computed by hashing the message. Right? When we get the message, we hash the message, we decrypt the hash that's in the message, compare them. If they're equal, the message is unchanged. So Alice knows that Bob signed, it wasn't somebody else, and that what he signed was the message she got and not something else. So, now, here's the system perspective that is not talked about in the slides, but you have to keep in mind with all of this. Mathematically, this is all very beautiful, right? Seems just fine. But notice what the assumptions are here. The assumption is that Bob's private key is only held by Bob. Okay? Think about the real world. Think about what it takes to record a 128-bit key. You don't remember it, right? You write it down. Well, you don't want to write it down in a public place. You probably write it down in a file and then encrypt the file with something that's private entirely to yourself and blah, 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 blah. Okay. But the assumption is, all this is based on assumptions about secrecy of the keys in the real world. Okay? And there's nothing that mathematics can tell you about the secrecy of keys in the real world. And so it's a little disturbing to me that that we're going around making laws that say, you know, if something is apparently signed with Bob's private key, necessarily Bob signed it. Okay? That's probably not how you want the law to read. Right. Maybe you want there to be a presumption that Bob signed it, but that there's some way to show that maybe Bob didn't. Just like Bob could, when you see Bob's handwritten signature on a document, maybe there's a presumption that Bob signed it, but there's got to be a way to say that, well, maybe Bob didn't, because there are ways in the physical world that maybe this doesn't hold. Okay? And so in any situation where you're using this stuff, you have to be really worried, not just about the mathematics of the situation, but also all the physical security that goes around maintaining this stuff and so on and so forth. Okay, we're going to stop there with that, but just one other thought about this. See if I can formulate this. Oh, yes. Okay. The other thought about all this is that I want to leave you with is that if you're ever in a situation where you're asked to do something to provide integrity of messages or secrecy of messages or anything like that, that you strongly, strongly, strongly resist the temptation to invent something. Okay? It's probably not so bad now, but there was a period when people building software that had to include some kind of encryption would just sort of willy-nilly build something off the top of their heads, then claim it was secure. Think voting machine implementers, for example. The mathematicians and the guys who do this professionally subject their proposals to years of review by equally knowledgeable and smart people before they release them on the world. And certainly there's no reason to think that an individual in the midst of an implementation of something else, is going to come up with anything that's any good at all. Okay? So that's the final thought I want to leave you about cryptography.